The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org. Last
week of this four-week series of an overview of the Buddhist teachings. And just as a little summary, a brief summary of the class so far, primarily, I have really been focusing through the lens of the Four Noble Truths. So the first week, we talked about suffering and the cause of suffering, and that understanding suffering is a huge part of the path of Buddhist practice. During the second week, I really focused on the path itself, which is the fourth noble truth. So the first week I focused on the first two noble truths, the truth of suffering and the truth of the cause of suffering. The second week I focused on the path of what is cultivated, how we engage in the path of practice through the avenue of sila, cultivating ethical conduct, then opening to mental cultivation, cultivating our minds through the factors of right effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. Those three factors coming together to really build our meditation practice so that we can see into our experience clearly to understand suffering. That's the whole kind of direction of the path of practice. And then the third aspect of the path being what is cultivated, the wisdom that results from engaging in this practice. So last week, the third week, I talked about through this process of engaging with the practice that we begin to understand how to live our lives more skillfully. And there are certain understandings that manifest. So I talked primarily about the understandings into impermanence, suffering, and not self last week. So tonight I'd like to talk about an additional aspect of the wisdom teachings of the Buddha. A little bit more about this wisdom that we gain and understand. And then hopefully I will have time to also talk about some of the qualities of mind, some of the beautiful qualities of mind that are cultivated as we walk on this path of practice. I've been focusing so much on suffering and greed, aversion, and delusion. You might all think that that's all there is to this. So I want to open it up to some of these other qualities that come along. Actually, these qualities come along for the ride. So tonight, talking a little bit more about wisdom, I'd like to talk about this teaching called dependent origination. This is really a detailed exposition of the second noble truth, the cause of suffering. So I'll talk just a little bit about this in general terms to kind of give you a broad brush sense of this, which I talked about some the first week, but just to review how suffering is caused. The basic cause of suffering named in the Second Noble Truth is that suffering is caused by craving. So this craving is a kind of a wanting that's a sense of urgency of something needing to change or something needing to be different in our lives or needing to have something in order to be happy. It's kind of got a sense of a drive behind it. Sometimes Gill calls it drivenness when he talks about this kind of wanting. So not all desire is necessarily unskillful. And in fact, all through our practice, we may need to desire certain things in order to engage in the practice itself. I mean, the practice itself is motivated by a form of desire. So this is really about looking at when desire is skillful and unskillful. And the kind of desire that propels us to want things, to want to change, to manipulate, to fix the environment so that it will suit us, that kind of wanting is generally not so helpful. It's a kind of a wanting that's trying to manipulate the conditions of the world. And the kind of a wanting that's a little more skillful is a wanting to change the internal landscape, a wanting to look at where the contribution this mind and body makes to its own suffering, and what can I do about that here and now. So not all suffering not all wanting is bad. So the kind of wanting that we're talking about is this kind of sense of urgency or drive, a drivenness to fix, change, manipulate something. And when we think of wanting or desire, we often think about some things we want to have, things we want to have in our lives. But this wanting of the second noble truth, the craving that leads to suffering, also includes wanting to get rid of things that we don't like. So these are the forms of, this is movements of desire and aversion. And they're both forms of craving. Both desire and aversion are forms of craving. So the movement of desire and aversion is typically rooted in whether we find something pleasant or unpleasant. When things are pleasant, we like them, we want them. We want to get more of them. And that wanting is kind of born out of the pleasant. When things are unpleasant, we don't like them, we want to get rid of them. And again, that aversion is born out of a reaction or a response to that unpleasant experience. Now, as we begin to observe this movement in our minds, this movement from pleasant to liking to wanting, unpleasant, not liking, not wanting, we actually start to see that it's the wanting itself that is the source of the suffering, not the thing that we want. So it's not the thing in the world that's causing the suffering, it's the wanting itself. So just taking a simple example, very simple, mundane example of a chocolate craving. When you, if you have a craving for a piece of chocolate, if you have that craving, that feeling of just wanting to have the chocolate, when you have the chocolate, when you eat it, that feeling of craving goes away. And there's a moment of feeling of satisfaction of having had the chocolate. This kind of experience happens to us over and over and over again in our lives, that when we get something that we want, we have this moment of satisfaction, such that we begin to believe, we begin to think that the only way to end our dissatisfaction is to get what we want. And what we start to see as we engage in this practice is that a way to end the dissatisfaction is to wait it out. You can simply just watch the wanting. The wanting, being an impermanent phenomenon, will eventually disappear, and you will notice that the dissatisfaction about not having the chocolate goes with it. When the wanting disappears, the dissatisfaction disappears, the suffering disappears. But we have over and over again had this experience of getting what we want, getting a brief moment of satisfaction, and so that we think that's the way to satisfy our desires, getting what we want. So we end up on this cycle of some kind of, you know, dissatisfaction, some kind of thinking things aren't right, then kind of an orientation to something in our world. Oh, if I got that thing, then I'd be happy. Manipulating the environment to get that thing, having it for a few moments, having a feeling of satisfaction. That fades, that dies after a short time, and then we're back onto, oh, well, what's the next thing that will do it for me? So we end up on this cycle. The Buddha described this cycle in very great detail in his teaching on the chain of dependent origination. So he actually discovered or uncovered a whole sequence of causal events that work together to create the suffering in our lives. He understood how it all fit together. So primarily this teaching is a description of how suffering comes to be in our experience. So there are 12 links in this chain, as you can see on the handout that I gave you. Ignorance, conditions, mental formations, and I'll go through all of these. Mental formation conditions consciousness, which conditions mind and matter, which conditions the six sense bases, which conditions contact, meaning contact of the world with some sense base. The sense bases being seeing, smelling, hearing, tasting, touching, and the mind. Contact with the sense base. Then that contact with the sense base producing some feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. That feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral conditioning craving, wanting, or not wanting. That craving conditioning clinging. When we want something, we tend to grab onto it. Clinging, conditioning, becoming, which I'll describe more later. Becoming, conditioning, birth. Conditioning, aging, and death. And sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Thus arising the entire mass of suffering, which is a quote from the suttas. And thus arises the entire mass of suffering. So this chain of dependent origination, it has a cyclic nature that essentially, it doesn't just go from top to bottom here, that once we end up with sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, and thus arises the entire mass of suffering, out of suffering arises ignorance. And so we are back at the top. So we end up in this, the Buddha describes this as not just a chain, but really a cycle of conditions that just keep reinforcing themselves. So it's a cyclic chain, and it also, it's a causative chain, that basically there's a causal relationship between each of the links. So ignorance, conditioning, how our mind works. And again, I'll go over this in more detail. There's a couple of different types of causation that I want to talk about here. In the Abhidhamma, the Buddhist texts that kind of just break all of the teachings down into very categorical descriptions, they describe 24 types of causation. I don't have a clue about all of those, but there are a few that I would like to highlight. There's a mutual conditioning, where one will not arise. When one arises, the other arises. They essentially, you cannot have one without the other. So there's a mutual kind of conditioning. There's similar, related to this, is a co-arising, two things arising together. Perhaps in that there's a distinction between the mutual conditioning, that these two things arising together may arise together sometimes and may not arise together sometimes. They describe them as two different ones, and I'm not completely clear on the distinction between them. And then there's the third one, the third main one is a kind of inducement where something happens because of something else. That's kind of the more traditional sense of causation that we think of, that when something happens, it causes something else to happen. And both of these, the mutual conditions, the arising together, the inducement, all of these types of causation are reflected in this chain of dependent origination. So the classical teaching on this cycle from the commentaries breaks this chain down into three different lives where some of the aspects, some of the links in the chain were having happened in a previous life, some of them are happening in this life, and some of them will happen in a future life. And I've drawn lines on here to show the differences in the lives. So in this kind of classical teaching, ignorance and mental formations are talked about as having been in the previous life. Consciousness down through becoming is what's happening in this life. And birth, aging, and death will be happening in a future life. Now, it's my own belief, not that I've found this anywhere, but it's my own belief that this particular form of the teaching is kind of a pedagogical tool, that at the time of the Buddha, pretty much an understanding of rebirth was it was considered accepted. It was not questioned. And people understood that there were previous lives and there would be future lives. And it wasn't something they had to work hard to wrap their minds around. And so this way of laying it out might have been helpful for people in terms of understanding this very complex teaching. For us, it seems to make it more difficult to add the concept of lifetimes to it, at least for me. It does. And I also, I've known for quite a while that there is a teaching of this chain of dependent origination that is supported by the suttas, by the Buddha's actual words, that describes this chain not as a multiple lifetime teaching, but as a moment-to-moment teaching, that this chain of events actually unfolds in very rapid succession over a few moments at a time. And essentially, we end up cycling through this process of conditions with birth and aging and death, essentially referring to the birth of a phenomenon and the cessation of a phenomenon. So, and then I just recently discovered that it's actually in the Abhidhamma. There are descriptions of both kinds of dependent origination, the three life formula and the moment to moment unfolding description, and that in the Abhidhamma, which is part of the Pali Canon, it's part of the actual root teachings, the root. Teachings from the Buddha. In the Abhidhamma, there are 72 pages devoted to the moment-to-moment unfolding of this, and 5 pages devoted to the description of the three life formula. And I found that amazing, actually, because I've always been taught it, or had originally been taught it with this three life formula, and was only told that this version of the moment-to-moment arising of the dependent origination was a relatively new invention. But it's in there. It's in the suttas. It's in the Tipitaka. It's in the original texts. Now, the Abhidhamma is a later. It's not not spoken by the Buddha. It's a couple hundred years after the Buddha. But in actuality, the discourses of the Buddha, what the Buddha actually spoke, can be interpreted in both ways, where it can be interpreted over multiple lifetimes, and it can be interpreted as the unfolding of suffering as it's created moment to moment in our experience. And from my perspective, this second way of approaching it as a moment to moment unfolding of experience and how suffering is created in the moment is much more relevant to my direct experience. I've seen parts of this chain working. I can't say that I've seen the entire thing working, but I've definitely seen parts of it in my direct experience. So for me, that's how I will approach the description, the discussion of this teaching, is as a description of suffering as it unfolds in this life, moment to moment. The easiest place to begin this discussion is in the middle portion of the chain, in what is commonly talked about as being the part that happens in this life. So starting with consciousness, mind, and matter. So I'm not going to begin the discussion with ignorance. I'm going to start with consciousness and mind and matter. And I'm going to do this hopefully in a way that will be comprehensible and practical, understandable, and feel free to ask questions while we're going through this. This just as a kind of a caveat or a, I don't know what the right word is, but at one point, one of the Buddha's attendants, Ananda, came to him and said something kind of lively and energetic, and said something to the Buddha like, "This teaching on dependent origination, it seems so complex, but to me it seems so clear." And the Buddha's response was, "Don't say that, Ananda. This teaching seems complex, and it is complex. It is for not understanding this teaching that beings wander in suffering. When you have understood this teaching, you have basically penetrated my teachings. You have understood the end of suffering." So the Buddha equates a complete understanding of this with liberation, with complete and full enlightenment. So we're probably not going to get it here tonight. But I hope that I can make it understandable and also perhaps show you some of the usefulness of this teaching. That it is not simply an experiment in thinking about, there's actually some aspects of this teaching that are incredibly useful to us in our daily practice. So starting with consciousness and mind and matter, these two together. These two are talked about as being mutually arising. In one particular sutta, that you cannot have one without the other. That if you take consciousness away, mind and matter will fall apart. If you take mind and matter away, consciousness will fall apart. So they come up together. So because we have this consciousness and we have this body and mind, we have these six sense bases. The six sense bases being sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch, the five normal sense bases that we think of. The sixth sense being, the sixth sense base being the base of the mind. So much as our eye receives sight, our ear receives sound, our mind receives mental impressions. It receives thoughts, it receives emotions, moods, intentions, attitudes. So the mind is considered a sense door in the Buddhist psychology. So we experience sense input from the five sense doors, six sense doors, and those, through that input, so that we're now at the six sense bases leading to contact, the sights, things from the world impinge upon our eye, sounds impinge upon our ears. There's contact with the sense base. Thoughts arise in our mind, and we know the thoughts. So that's contact. We experience sight, sound, smell, taste, touch through our five physical sense bases. We experience emotions, thoughts, moods through the sense door of the mind. Each of these sense impressions, sights, sounds, smells, thoughts, emotions, moods, has a feeling tone to it. It's either pleasant, it's unpleasant, or it's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. It's neutral. That's a very basic process that happens in our minds. This feeling tone of experience is a mental process of recognizing that something is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. There may be a physical contact of unpleasant, but the feeling unpleasant is experienced by the mind. Out of that feeling, based on that feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, in a very simple, straightforward, natural way, if something's pleasant, we like it and we want it. If something is unpleasant, we don't like it, we want to get rid of it. If something's neutral, we often space out about it and we don't really connect with it. So we're kind of like this simple automatic machine, kind of like a amoeba-like, that we navigate towards the pleasant, we move away from the unpleasant. So we're just trying in some way to maximize pleasant, minimize unpleasant in our experience. It's a very natural, almost biological movement, that movement. So this moving towards the pleasant, moving away from the unpleasant, often moves into craving. Wanting the pleasant, wanting to get rid of the unpleasant. So this movement, this kind of simple biological movement, moves into a kind of a craving, a needing to have something or not have something. So that's the craving. From craving, that wanting follows on clinging. We usually kind of automatically act on this wanting to try to get the thing that we want. One teacher described the distinction between craving and clinging as the movement of a thief. When a thief is moving to reach out for something he's going to steal, that's craving. When he's actually picked it up and taken it, that's clinging. So it's like one following from the other. It's a process of one leading to another. Once something is clung to, we tend to maneuver our intentions and actions to be in the service of that clinging, to produce or control things. So our intentions, our actions kind of get channeled to support the clinging. This is called becoming. This kind of intentional actions that support the clinging. We actually like becoming. Becoming feels good because it feels like we know what we're doing, we know where we're going, we know how we're going to get there. Feel like we've got some control.
That's where the notion of identity comes from.
That's a little later. Yeah, the birth is the identity. The becoming is the kind of the intentions and actions that are kind of guiding us there. So this feels kind of good to us, this feeling of becoming. Following on from becoming is the notion of birth, which in the three-life model is considered to be the actual birth, you know, the arising into the womb of consciousness. But in this moment-to-moment model, birth is essentially the arising of an identity, the clear sense of things becoming me or mine, or I am the one who's in control. So this might be something as simple as this is my glass, or it might be more of an idea of I'm the kind of person who X. I'm the kind of person who is honest, or I'm the kind of person who runs things really well. Dependent origination can also be understood as describing how the whole process of selfing works. This whole idea that we have a self, the belief in a self, this chain also basically describes this process of the process of a self feeling arising and a believing in it. The movement towards a self is the becoming, and the arising and the believing in the self is the birth. And from this point, suffering is inevitable. This might result from some kind of obvious separation from what I consider mine, or it might result from some dismantling or pointing out to us by the world that who we think we are is not accurate. So that gives you a little bit of a flavor. And to make it a little more clear, I'm going to give two examples going through this from consciousness down to aging and death. One, a sense pleasure example, because that's kind of the most obvious way that this unfolds. But it's not the most pernicious way. So I'll start with the contact. We've got the mind and body, we've got the six sense bases, and we have contact. We've got something in our experience that's pleasant, something in our world that we want, some pleasant experience, some physical object that we want. So the seeing of this object produces a feeling of pleasantness. That pleasantness produces a feeling of wanting, a wanting to have that pleasant thing, which produces the resultant clinging, the actions designed to take possession of that thing. Once we've got taken possession of that thing, there is the becoming, is the intention and the action to control things according to that clinging, according to that possession. So, for example, you might want to keep the thing safe or keep the thing protected. So having the thing, you now have some kind of intention and action to control the thing. The birth is the clear sense of identification and possessiveness. This is my thing. A feeling that I own or possess and or control that thing. And then aging and death. One who possesses something must ultimately be separated from it in some way. This may be because of loss. The thing is lost or stolen. It may be because the thing degenerates itself. It may be because you die, that there will ultimately be some separation between you and this thing. All possession ends in separation. So there's the suffering if there's a loss. There's a suffering. There can be a suffering because of a fear of losing something. The suffering that we experience is in direct proportion to the amount of attachment and identification we have with that thing. Just think about that in your own experience. There's something that you are really attached to really identify with as mine. There's more suffering if there's separation from that thing than with something that you're less attached to. So the suffering is directly related to the amount of identification, the amount of attachment to the thing. Now, the second example I want to give is more related to what I might call a life state. So there's some idea that arises. This is contact with the mind now, that this is the sense base of the mind. Contact with the mind. Some idea of some kind of being appears in our mind. The idea, perhaps, of being rich or famous. It arises as a thought or as a fantasy in our mind. Wouldn't that be nice if I were rich or famous? There might be a feeling of pleasure as a result of that fantasy. Now, sometimes those fantasies just kind of come and go, and it's like, yeah, they don't really grab us. There's just the fantasy, there's kind of a pleasantness of it, and then you kind of wake up into real life. It's like, oh, right, okay, here I am, I've got my things to do. Sometimes these kind of thoughts actually grab us, and they begin to motivate our lives. So at that point, we would say that wanting has arisen. So there's this wanting to follow through somehow, a wanting to be rich or famous. The clinging aspect of this is where, so there's the wanting to be rich or famous, and the clinging is where this becomes a fixed idea. It's like that it's not just something we want, it's actually this need. I need to be rich in order to be happy. I'm going to make this happen. This is important. So there's kind of this fixed idea, a fixed attitude around this state of being. So that's the clinging to that. Once we have this fixed attitude around this thing, we start to change our behaviors. We begin to exhibit patterns of behavior and character traits, perhaps, that will get us to accomplish this thing. This is becoming. This is the way becoming works. It's the intentions and actions designed to support the clinging, to move towards supporting that clinging, to kind of aligned with the idea of the cling of the being rich. So these are patterns aligned with this idea. Patterns and habits of mind. So, for example, in this case of around being rich or famous, there might be, you know, patterns around working long hours, or perhaps patterns of arrogance that might arise. So that's becoming. And then birth. For simplicity's sake, for this example, let's assume that these behavior patterns have led to success. Become rich, you become famous. The birth would be the distinct feeling of self that arises as one who is rich or famous. I am rich, I am famous. Or the feeling of successful. There's in this birth, not only in this scenario, but I think also in the sense pleasure scenario, there's generally an augmentation of a distinction between self and other that happens with the sense of self that comes into place. Self doesn't come into place without a sense of other. So there's self and other. So now we have a self occupying a position of wealth and fame. And ultimately, it sooner or later will be deprived of this position. This might happen through loss, theft, stock market crashing. It might also happen through ideas, this aging and death of this identity of being rich. Perhaps you meet someone who has more money, who's more famous than you, and suddenly your success seems not quite so exalted. So there's a sense of, oh, well, maybe I have more work to do. Maybe I'm not so successful. Maybe I'm not so famous. So the actual loss, if you gained this wealth and fame, the loss of that is suffering. The threat of loss is suffering. The fear of loss is suffering. And the belief that you have, even if it's just a shift in your own mind, no change in your own scenario at all, except for the idea that person has a bigger house, that person has 5 cars, that person has whatever. By comparison, there's a feeling of less than self and other, less than, and so there's a feeling of diminishment. So that covers the 10 of the links of dependent origination. Now I'm going to go back and talk about the first couple of links: ignorance to mental formations to consciousness. So because this chain is cyclic, it helps to remember that this first link, ignorance, is conditioned by suffering. In fact, the Buddha said that suffering will tend to lead either to confusion, ignorance, bewilderment, or it will lead to search. So in a few moments, we'll come back to this idea of suffering leading to search, because this is one of the ways out of this problem. It's one of the ways out of this cycle. So ignorance in this teaching, in the Buddhist teaching, ignorance basically means not understanding the Four Noble Truths. It means a fundamental misunderstanding around a belief in self. So the basic condition for suffering to lead to ignorance is for suffering to not be understood. That's the first noble truth, that understanding suffering is one of the keys. So if we take suffering and apply our minds to understand it, we can begin to move away from this chain. But not understanding suffering will lead us right back into ignorance. So with ignorance as a condition, because we don't understand how suffering really operates, we believe that there is someone here acting and doing, based on the ignorance, our intentions and actions are formed about how we choose things, we do things, how we behave. These are mental formations. The mental formation is basically a intentional aspects of the mind that move us into action. They're essentially patterns and habits of our minds. So out of ignorance, we begin to act in unskillful ways. We take the kind of obvious step to get rid of our unpleasant sensations, hang on to our pleasant ones, which leads us right through this cycle. So the ignorance about not understanding suffering leads us to behave in ways that perpetuate suffering. And these mental formations basically being these habits and patterns that lead us through this cycle. So we think that we're acting to alleviate our suffering when we try to get what we want and get rid of what we don't want. But in actuality, we are perpetuating our suffering when we act in that way. So that is ignorance leading to mental formations. So the next few links are a little more confusing. And I'm going to try to explain them with some examples. And this is just the simplest of examples. So the first, mental formation conditions consciousness. So we can think of this as when we have some particular habits and patterns in our mind stream, it will kind of condition the way our consciousness works. So for example, if you have a kind of a habit or pattern of being angry a lot, then it will condition the consciousness to kind of choose out of the environment things that support that anger. We have a filtering mechanism, I think, that is kind of very inherent in our psyches. I mean, it's not even just our conditioning, it's kind of pattern recognition. When we're trying to do something and accomplish something, it's helpful that our minds will pick out patterns that support us to do that thing. So as another kind of example for this, at one point I had a massive outbreak of Bermuda grass in my garden, and I was trying to pull it up. And at first, when I first started to do it, it was, you know, kind of like finding the Bermuda grass. Well, first it was obvious, you know, it was pretty much everywhere. And then as it got more weeded out, it was harder to find. But at some point, I realized that I could just look, and immediately I was spotting the Bermuda grass. It was like this filtering mechanism, because I was focused on this task of doing this, pulling the Bermuda grass weed, the consciousness became attuned to that. So this filtering mechanism kind of just supported that. I even, you know, I'd close my eyes and I would see Bermuda grass. So, you know, this filtering mechanism actually, I think, is a way that we are designed to accomplish things. And it gets co-opted by our habits and patterns. So the mental formations, our habits and patterns, will condition our consciousness. Based on our kind of consciousness, the state of our consciousness, the kind of flavor or tone of our consciousness, if our consciousness is attuned to finding things that, we're kind of picking things out of the environment that support the idea of anger. So if our consciousness is kind of attuned that way, this may also impact our mind and body. That next link, consciousness conditioning mind and matter. So this is a slightly different version. Before I'd said that mind and matter come up together. This is a way in which there's a way that the condition of the mind impacts the mind and body in an inducement kind of way. That if the condition of the mind is attuned to experiencing anger and kind of pulling things out of the environment that will support that state of mind, the body may become tense, the face may become slightly distorted from anger, the mind is tending to pull out of the environment things that may be experienced as unpleasant, it will perceive things in a way that's interpreted as, I should be angry about that. This is how a kind of a flavor of consciousness can condition how the rest of mind and body are functioning. So now we're back to the place where we started. Because we have a mind and body, we have sense desire. But we now see that the mind and body that we are approaching sense desire with is not a neutral environment. It's colored by all kinds of views, opinions, habits and patterns. It's taking in information in a filtered way, inclining us to cling, inclining us to get what we want, get rid of what we don't want. So because this chain describes the conditions that support the arising of suffering, feeling leads to craving, leads to clinging, leads to becoming. It also follows that if the conditions are not present, suffering will not arise. And this is a key piece of the teaching. So attention to and understanding how any of these links work will serve to help us dismantle the suffering. So we can approach this chain at any point and bring our understanding to any point in this chain. We can pick the link of suffering or the aging and death which leads to the massive suffering. We can pick the link of contact, of just getting, you know, hit the sense impressions coming in. If we understand those, we can find that we don't have to be automatically moving along this chain. So the teaching is that you can understand any one link clearly, and it will help to dismantle the entire chain. And the Buddha also pointed to some particular weak links in the chain that are the easiest places to begin to pull out of this. The two main weak links are between suffering, or between aging and death, and ignorance. If you bring your attention to suffering with wisdom instead of ignorance, if you bring your attention to the experience, as I've been talking about the last few weeks, bringing mindfulness, investigation, to understand suffering, we can circumvent the link that leads from suffering to ignorance. When suffering is met with wisdom, it heads in another direction. And in fact, there's an entirely a different teaching called the chain of transcendent dependent origination that goes from suffering. And instead of going around to ignorance, when suffering is met with wisdom, it leads to faith. Faith in the possibility. And then it moves to gladness, to rapture, tranquility, happiness, concentration, knowledge and understanding, dispassion, liberation. So the work at this link, the weakness of that link, is bringing wisdom to the suffering, bringing understanding, bringing mindfulness to the suffering, can break us out of this automatic, almost what feels like an automatic cycle. Another weak link is between feeling and craving. this is the link between something is pleasant, we like it, we want it. That kind of almost automatic movement when we experience something that's pleasant to move to get it. Or that almost automatic movement when something's unpleasant to push it away. We can, through attending to the experience of feeling itself, attending to just the feeling of pleasant, just the feeling of unpleasant, we can short-circuit that movement to wanting through simply paying attention to the feeling itself. So I have about 12 minutes. We have 12 minutes here. I'll leave it to you. Would you like to have questions about dependent origination, or would you like me to go on to the qualities, the positive, wholesome qualities that we cultivate? Qualities. Okay. One thing I want to say about dependent origination, the bottom of this handout, I've offered some references for further study. The first one is an excellent, clear, it's very clear discussion. The second one is this book, The Shape of Suffering. There's several of them out on the counter. If you would like a copy, you're welcome to take this book. They're free books. And the third one is a kind of a radical different approach to dependent origination by Buddhadasa. He really dismisses the three life version completely and says that's a bunch of hogwash. So these are I think my three favorite discussions of this topic, best places to start if you're interested in more information. So far, we've been talking a lot in the last few weeks about suffering, letting go of suffering, the path leading to the end of suffering, letting go of greed, aversion, and delusion. We've talked a little bit about greed, aversion, and delusion as being unskillful motivations for our actions, and non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion being skillful motivations for our actions. So non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion is not the absence, actually, of something. More positively, we could call those generosity, kindness, and wisdom. So as we practice, as we engage in this practice of letting go of suffering and understanding greed, aversion, and delusion, we begin to cultivate non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, which is not nothing. It's actually uncovering, in a sense, beautiful qualities of mind. So the absence of these qualities is not just blankness. It's actually a beautiful, openness of heart. And there are a couple of different lists that I'll just go through really quickly here that describe some of the qualities that result through this path of practice. One of these is the list called the Paramis, and Paramis is generally translated as perfection. These are generosity, virtue, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, and equanimity. Generosity, virtue, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, and equanimity.
There is a really good list on the IMC website.
Ah, yes. There's a list of many lists on the IMC website. I can't remember the link. Lists?
On the left side, it says
Dharma lists. Yeah, there's many, many lists there. You'll probably find dependent origination on that page as well. So these are qualities of mind that we both cultivate as we practice, so we can actively cultivate these qualities, and they result from our practice. We don't actually have to actively cultivate them. They can come along for the ride. If we are cultivating understanding suffering, non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, these qualities start to come along for the ride. They are the qualities of an open heart. When our heart opens, these qualities are present. These qualities are said to be the qualities that the Buddha to be in his many previous lifetimes. The mythology of the Buddha is that he had many, many lifetimes preparing to become the Buddha, and that these are the qualities that he cultivated, that he worked on, that he was actively cultivating during those many, many lifetimes. So we can actively cultivate them, and it is said that in his awakening, they became perfected. That they, essentially, the qualities of an open heart are the qualities of an enlightened heart. And as we, if we engage in cultivating any one of these practices, any one of these qualities, if we even begin with one of them, for instance, if we look at the first one, generosity. We see that the others can be cultivated as we engage in that one. So I did this kind of reflection about how the others would be connected. How would all of the qualities of the other paramis be related to generosity? So as we practice generosity, we are naturally connecting ourselves to others because generosity is a connecting practice. And as we become connected to others, we naturally want to not harm them, which is virtue. Non-harming is virtue. As we practice generosity, we are letting go of what we are giving, which is cultivating renunciation. As we practice generosity, we're learning the benefits of giving. We're seeing how giving benefits us, how it's skillful, how it leads us away from suffering, how it cultivates non-clinging. This is cultivating wisdom. The effort to practice generosity, making the engagement to practice generosity, cultivates energy, the fifth parami. We also get energy as we experience the joy of giving. When we give and really rejoice in giving, there's a kind of an energy that comes from that. Patience. We cultivate patience because we sometimes see how hard it is to let go of things. How judgmental we can get about ourselves. So patience is cultivated as we engage over and over again, seeing our difficulties. Truthfulness. We learn to be honest with ourselves about what true generosity is. Not wanting something in return. About what truly constitutes giving. What truly constitutes generosity? Resolve, similar to patience in a way, that we have to keep determining. Determination is another, resolve is another word for determination. We have to keep determining to continue to engage. It's not like we can just say, oh, I'll be generous and then forget about it. We need to keep going. Loving kindness. as we give to others, again, the connection that develops begins to promote a feeling of kindness. One of the main antidotes is said to feeling animosity towards somebody is to give them a gift. Because it is such a direct connection when you think about what somebody might like and offer them that gift. It's such a direct connection, it supports the movement of kindness. And equanimity. We learn to be balanced about what we let go of when we're giving. We learn to be balanced around expectations. Equanimity is balance of mind. We learn about not needing to have our generosity produce a particular result. So all of these qualities, just even picking one, pulls the others along with it. And in the last minute, I'll do one other list, a different list, which is related to the last two paramis, kindness and equanimity. The Brahmaviharas, the divine abodes. Kindness is the opening of the heart, the connecting of the heart, not only to others, but to our own experience. Not only to the situations of others, but to our own experience. And as we open our minds with mindfulness to our experience, we see actually that this quality of kindness to our own experience begins to arise. That in a sense, mindfulness is a kind of a loving attention. So that mindfulness begins to bring up this quality of kindness to ourselves and to our own experience. And we also start to connect to others through the understanding of suffering and avoiding suffering, not wanting to cause harm. It begins to open our hearts to others. So as we open our hearts to others, as our hearts open with the feeling of kindness, we also begin to notice that that open heart responds to suffering with compassion. It responds to joy with sympathetic joy. When that open heart of kindness meets suffering, the natural response is one of compassion. This is one of the second of the Brahmaviharas, the second of these qualities. The third being this sympathetic joy, that when the open heart meets someone who is happy, happiness is the natural response. The fourth of these qualities is equanimity, and it's the quality that is needed to balance the open heart from getting pulled into the suffering or pulled into the getting swept away by the excitement of joy and happiness. So these four qualities also are cultivated as we practice and also result from the practice. I like to think of these four, metta, compassion, or loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, as the map or the emotional map of the awakened heart. These are the qualities that we end up with as we practice. Well, that took me 3 minutes. It's 9:02, so thank you for your patience. So I hope that this class has been of benefit. May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be safe. May all beings be at ease. May all beings be free from suffering. Thank you.